From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests will be two epidemiologists from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. First, Dan Jernigan is joining us to look at the increasing problem of antibiotic resistance among bacteria that cause serious infections in hospitals and other healthcare facilities. And we'll also be focusing on a new strain of Staph aureus that is causing serious skin infections, even among people who have not been hospitalized. Then, later in the show, Niranjan Bhatt is joining us to discuss avian influenza, aggressive viruses that have decimated domestic poultry in Asia and have demonstrated the ability to also cause serious disease in exposed people. So stay with us for today's infectious disease update. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Before World War II, the predominant strategy for treating serious infections was to cut away infected tissue, amputate infected limbs, provide fluids, and administer aspirin to control high fever. Then, during the Second World War, for the first time in history, medicines became available which could effectively treat many bacterial infections. The sulfa drugs and penicillin during the 1940s and 50s represented some of the most important advances in the history of medicine. But barely had these antibiotics come into widespread use when reports came out of bacterial strains that were able to grow despite the administration of these antibiotics. And now, 60 years into the antibiotic era, the problem of antibiotic resistance among bacteria has become increasingly widespread. This problem is concentrated in hospitals, where extremely ill individuals have diminished resistance to infection, and the widespread use of antibiotics exerts selection pressure, promoting the rapid evolution of resistant bacteria. A few bacterial strains have been identified that are resistant to virtually every available antibiotic. One example is a Staph aureus strain that is resistant to methicillin and most other available antibiotics. But just in the last few years, we have begun to see strains of resistant bacteria even outside of hospitals. One highly antibiotic-resistant strain of Staph aureus recently caused serious skin infections among several members of the St. Louis Rams professional football team. This was considered especially alarming since these football players are clearly well-nourished, robust, and would hardly be thought of as especially susceptible to infection. Joining us today to discuss antibiotic-resistant strains of Staph aureus is Dan Jernigan, a medical doctor and epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria has been the focus of his research at the CDC and elsewhere during his career. Dan Jernigan, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks.
Maybe we could start out if you would describe what is meant when we use the term methicillin-resistant Staph aureus.
Well, I think it may be important to think of Staphylococcus aureus itself before getting into the resistance part of it, but the bacteria Staph aureus is one of the most common causes of skin infections in the United States and worldwide. It can cause a spectrum of disease, but the vast majority of illness that's due to Staph aureus is skin disease, like impetigo and skin infections like that, abscesses. But in some people, it can go on to give really bad pneumonia or progress to things like meningitis or severe bone infections. We know that in the 1950s, there was the emergence of resistance to penicillin among the staphylococci, and then subsequently in the 70s, really the emergence of what's called methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. when we say methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, what we're really talking about historically is that hospital problem of resistant staphylococcus that gets spread from person to person and often causes healthcare-associated infections.
When you're using the term methicillin-resistant for this bacterium, it's not just methicillin, but the entire classes of all the drugs related to penicillin, all the cephalosporin antibiotics, and those two classes really constitute some of the workhorse antibiotics that we use in trying to treat these infections. So it's not just one antibiotic. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely true, and that's what's so important about MRSA, and that is that really what it means is that it is resistant to that whole class of the, what we call the beta-lactam antibiotics, which are the cephalosporins, the penicillins, all those drugs that are commonly used, and also the drugs that are the standard of care for treating skin infections in the outpatient setting.
Has this problem become so common that it needs to start affecting the selection of antibiotics?
That's a great question, and clearly in the hospital that's the case. If you look at the percent of infections that are due to staphylococcus in hospitals, especially in intensive care units, the percent that are the methicillin-resistant forms are at least half or up to 60 or 70% in some institutions. And so in the hospital, when somebody has an infection that looks like a staphylococcal infection, the standard of care there is to use something that would cover that particular bacteria, and that would be usually vancomycin. What we're seeing, though, is a new problem, not in the hospital but outside the hospital, where MRSA is emerging as a more frequent cause of skin and soft tissue infections like abscesses. And there is a difference between that bacteria that's outside the hospital compared to the one that's inside the hospital. And the one outside the hospital is resistant to all those beta-lactam antibiotics like penicillins and cephalosporins. But it also is sensitive to a couple of oral agents that are very effective for treating staphylococcus, which the healthcare bug is not. So that means that the one that's in the hospital tends to be a lot more resistant than the one we're seeing outside the hospital.
So what you're saying is that we're seeing a new strain out in the community among people who are relatively healthy of another version of resistant staph, but at least there's a few antibiotics available to treat that, whereas the hospital one is even harder to kill.
That's exactly right. And so for folks that are having to either treat or for public health folks that have to deal with this issue, it's real important to recognize that difference, that the in-hospital one is treated really with vancomycin and other drugs now. The one that's outside of the hospital does not require vancomycin, and that's something that some folks just haven't recognized yet. But there are a couple of things that make it very different between the in-hospital and the community one, and that is that, first of all, the one that's outside the hospital, what we call community-associated MRSA, actually contains a toxin called PVL. What that is a toxin that breaks down cells and can, we think, causes worse abscesses. And so there are some characteristic presenting findings for the community-associated MRSA cases. A lot of them are actually described as a spider bite. And in fact, there have been outbreaks of spider bites that have been reported. And even in the early investigations that we did, especially in prisons, they were actually thinking that it was a spider problem and having pest control come in, when in fact it was the transmission of this community-associated MRSA among the prisoners. So that there is a fairly characteristic presentation with abscess that can have a necrotic or dying skin center, and that really brings up the importance of diagnosis, especially for clinicians. And if you've got an abscess, I think historically we used to do incision and drainage on those abscesses, but over time doctors have gotten away from that because antibiotics are so effective. But now it's time to go back and start sticking a needle into those abscesses, doing some diagnosis on it, and also the drainage of that pus is a therapy as well.
It sounds like this community-acquired organism is a lot nastier an organism than what we've seen compared to other staphylococcal organisms we've been seeing, and it's resistant to many of the antibiotics we don't want to use. Is it known why that emerged? And as that infection keeps appearing, are there risk factors? Is there anything that an individual could do to try to not develop an infection from that organism?
Right. I think the emergence of this community strain, we don't fully understand why it's come up now. I mean, we can certainly surmise that this particular community strain is resistant to the beta-lactam antibiotics, but also to the macrolides, that is, things like erythromycin and azithromycin. Those two antibiotics are the most commonly used antibiotics, especially in kids, for treating otitis media and for treating upper respiratory tract infections. And so we know that in the community there is that pressure of antibiotics that are constantly being used, those two in particular. And that's one reason why one lineage of the Staphylococcus gained that resistance gene, and then it's able to maintain itself well because there is that antibiotic pressure. But equally, the toxin that it makes, which perhaps does increase the amount of pus that's made and the size of the abscesses, that may allow for there to be easier transmission from person to person because it can contaminate the environment a little better. So those are two things why this particular strain is maintaining itself and seems to be very well suited for causing infection and staying around in the community. We know that in the past, 20 years ago, even longer than that, when they did some investigations, you can see that different strains of Staphylococcus come and go over time. And I think what we're seeing now is this is the incoming one that seems to be more fit than some of the other strains, and either may be replacing existing staphylococci or may be in addition to existing staph disease. Historically, when the staphylococcus first became resistant to penicillin, there was a new clone that came out at that time that also contained PVL. And so what we may be seeing now is just the development of a more fit staphylococcus that is well suited for maintaining itself in the environment.
Tell me a little bit more about risk groups for these two different types of resistant staph.
The community strains of MRSA are circulating in the community, sometimes at a level that's not really detected by either clinicians as a prominent problem or by the public health folks. But when it gets into certain settings, we think that the conditions are right in those settings for there to be really efficient transmission. We think those factors are crowding. So certainly in prisons and military recruits, that's been a problem. Contaminated environment and shared items, bars or benches, that kind of thing, sharing of towels. Compromised skin, we think, is a real important factor as well. So turf burns, existing scrapes and cuts. Problems with cleanliness, where you have really not access to appropriate hygiene or you cannot maintain it. Either young guys who are playing football or prisoners who don't have access to soap. We think those things really play into it. And frequent skin-to-skin contact, we think, is an important factor as well. Two other factors may be access to care and also use of antibiotics. Recent report we had in the New England Journal of a outbreak among the St. Louis Rams, in that we were able to find that the football players were receiving 10 times the amount of antibiotics that the same age and gender in the general population would have been receiving. So we think that the increased antimicrobial pressure in certain groups really makes the transmission to be very efficient. Now, the question, I guess, is can a clinician use those kinds of risk factors to try and figure out who to give different kinds of therapy to? At this point, we don't really have anything to support that because we think, if a patient is coming in with an abscess and you're in a community or an area where you know that the community strains are circulating, that empiric therapy with a drug like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or clindamycin is a reasonable approach to do in that setting.
In other words, if the patient's pretty sick and having trouble right at the time, you may not be able to wait the 3 days until you get final results.
That's right. And honestly, if you look at the old literature on staphylococcus and even some of the new literature from some of the folks in Dallas, where they measured abscesses and lanced them and did an incision and drainage, they actually have some data that suggests that it is perhaps as effective to do incision and drainage as it is to do the antimicrobial therapy. So if you're in a community where you know there is some of the community-associated MRSA strains circulating, and somebody comes in with a large abscess, the best thing is to go ahead and drain it, send that off for culture, and do an empiric therapy that would cover that. At this point, we don't have any consensus from any of the standards groups that put together recommendations for therapy that make that kind of that change in empiric therapy. However, I do think the pediatricians and perhaps the IDSA will be commenting on that and will suggest that in certain areas that's a reasonable approach to change empiric therapy.
So far we've been talking about Staph aureus, which is one species of bacterium. But is that the only bacterium that we've been concerned about in terms of developing resistance to numerous antibiotics?
No, not at all. The Staphylococcus is sort of just the latest to join the crowd in the outpatient setting. It led the way, though, in resistance within the hospital. Our group is very interested in three areas right now of emerging antimicrobial resistance. Of course, one is the Staphylococcus with MRSA, but also with the gram-negative organisms like Acinetobacter and Pseudomonas, where the clinicians that are treating these patients in the intensive care unit are essentially out of antibiotics to treat. They have one left, which is called colistin, which is a very old antibiotic that people aren't even familiar with using, and it just hasn't been used a lot in the recent past and has some toxicities associated with it. So it's very important that we have new antimicrobials for the gram-negative organisms, these multi-resistant gram-negatives in the hospital. Another one that we're concerned about is Clostridium difficile, which is known as a common cause of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, so that if somebody takes antibiotics, then they get this particular anaerobic bacteria causing diarrhea. We now know there's a new emerging epidemic strain that it has been shown to make more of the toxin that causes the explosive diarrhea and causes virulent disease. But it's also resistant now to the fluoroquinolones like Cipro and levofloxacin. So all of these bacteria are continually finding ways to get around what we're coming up with. Outside of the hospital, certainly most clinicians are familiar with the emergence of the resistance in Streptococcus pneumoniae, the most common cause of ear infections and meningitis. That one is, of course, now resistant also to penicillins and other antibiotics. And, of course, the STD, the sexually transmitted disease pathogens, have developed resistance as well.
So antibiotic resistance is a big problem for many of the common infections that we have to treat. Maybe we could turn our attention now to prevention strategies.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like one obvious strategy is to cut down on antibiotic use. And if you could describe some of the measures the Center for Disease Control has developed to try to combat the development of resistant bacterial strains.
Well, it started really back in the mid-90s with investigators and researchers in our respiratory diseases group at CDC really trying to find those factors that lead physicians to prescribe antimicrobials inappropriately, and also for patients and parents who are demanding them for certain things that they probably ought not to be treated for. That led to a very large campaign that is available on the website, a lot of materials, to prevent antimicrobial use in the community. And then a newer campaign called Get Smart, Know How to Use Antimicrobials Wisely, which also is a campaign with a lot of materials that can be found on our website as well. In the hospital, a similar kind of campaign to prevent antimicrobial resistance is there. And it not only focuses on the use of antibiotics, but also on other measures to help prevent transmission. And I think that that's a factor to think about with the new community-associated MRSA as well. And that is that certainly we should be using antimicrobials targeted to the infections and not using them for viral infections and so forth. But also there are some simple measures that people can take to prevent transmission. one thing to remember is that resistant bacteria do not resist hand washing. And so simple measures like hand washing, good personal hygiene, making sure that wounds are covered and contained, those kinds of things probably do as much to prevent transmission and therefore prevent disease as trying to have broader measures with antimicrobial use. So there's general kinds of measures that can be done at trying to minimize the use of antibiotics, but also there are individual personal measures that can be taken to improve your own hygiene and make sure that you're not transmitting the bacteria as well.
But still in the United States, antibiotics require a prescription mm-hmm. by a doctor or another practitioner. And I guess I'd like to ask if you mentioned earlier the notion that we need to develop new antibiotics to treat certain gram-negative infections, but that may also be true for the hospital-acquired Staph aureus that's now becoming so resistant.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I guess that raises the question, listeners may not be aware that we really only have 6 or 7 classes of antibiotics available, and this becomes a problem when patients have allergies. So as we do develop new antibiotics, which doesn't really occur that often, has there been a thought at the level of national policymakers to try to reserve them and not encourage their use right away, but really think to do more restrictive policies that would keep doctors from prescribing them for minor things or inappropriately?
Well, certainly the nature of our medical system does not necessarily make it that easy to have those kinds of broad measures. I think we want to be able to let clinicians make their decisions about what is and what is not appropriate rather than try and have huge policies. But there have been efforts to change some of the HEDIS measures, which are those measures that are used through HMOs to determine how effective they are and their incentives essentially to try and use antimicrobials wisely. From the policy level, CDC, of course, is not able and does not lobby for those kinds of things, but there are societies like the Infectious Disease Society of America, which has made the development of new antimicrobials in one of their highest priorities, especially for the gram-negative organisms. So there's a lot of activity at that level. Exactly how to restrict and what is the best approach to management is really kind of a new issue. There are emerging antimicrobial management groups at various academic centers and various hospitals. People are being hired on to help try and implement antimicrobial management, that is, restrictions and trying to give information to direct clinicians to use the most appropriate antibiotic. It's a little early for us now to know which of those strategies are going to be most effective and which way to actually even measure the effectiveness of them. Those are things that are being developed now, but clearly healthcare facilities and institutions and systems are thinking about that and trying to develop ways to intervene. But the best way to do that, we just don't know yet.
Perhaps 15 years ago, I don't remember the exact year, I never forget this. I was reading a medical journal, and there was an advertisement for a drug called Fortaz, mm-hmm. which is also known as ceftazidime. And that was being developed to kill off resistant Pseudomonas, which is one of these highly resistant gram-negatives bacteria you mentioned earlier. And there were advertisements for months in journals without even describing what this drug was, even whether it was an antibiotic at all, just to get you interested. And then finally, over the several-month period, the advertisements became a little more specific, and you gradually came to learn that this was a new antibiotic and it was very broad spectrum. And if you think about the way the pharmaceutical industry works, they, after a drug is introduced, they want to recoup their investment quickly. They want a new drug used frequently and prescribed a lot right off the bat. They typically, advertising campaigns start out with an initial barrage and then maybe go down to a lower level later. And in some ways, this looks to me to be the exact opposite of what we might want to reserve new antibiotics so they may continue to be useful longer. Have you thought about this model that the pharmaceutical industry uses and that it and thought about ways to try to inhibit that or counter it?
You've raised a very interesting point regarding the market system and competition in the United States, and that is a part of the landscape that we are in, and how to improve that or even to comment on that, I'll leave to others at CDC that may deal with those kinds of policies at that level. But I think there are certainly ways, though, that public health can partner with industry to try and find ways that can benefit both. I don't think we've found that connection yet to solve the problems here, but certainly that's something that we should be doing, is trying to find ways within the existing system to improve it for better development of drugs and so forth. But again, that is a reflection of the way the system works right now, and I don't believe we're able to affect that right now.
And approximately 75% of the antibiotic use in the country has nothing to do with medicine or treatment of people, but occurs on farms. And I'm wondering if the CDC, the divisions of the CDC that have been concerned about antimicrobial resistance, if they've developed initiatives or policies to try to limit agricultural use, or if you have been concerned about that problem.
Well, there is a part of that campaign. We talked about the Get Smart campaign called Get Smart on the Farm, which actually does address that issue. There are veterinarians and other health policy folks at CDC that are dealing with that, coming up with strategies, trying to work with USDA and work with the food producers and with the agricultural industry.
Well, Dan Jernigan, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Sure, my pleasure.
Listeners wishing to learn more about these highly antibiotic-resistant bacteria should check out the website of the CDC, which is cdc.gov. That's cdc.gov. Coming up next, another epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Niranjan Bhatt, joins us to take a look at avian influenza, which has recently been spreading among both bird and human populations in several countries of the Far East. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Over the course of human history, influenza has been one of the most common and most deadly of all the infectious diseases. Just as human populations begin to develop resistance to the circulating influenza strains, new strains predictably develop to which few people are resistant. In some cases, such breakouts of new and highly resistant strains have led to worldwide catastrophes, such as the epidemic that killed over 20 million people just after World War I. Influenza viruses are quite capable of exchanging genetic material with related viruses, and strains of influenza which primarily affect animals are an important source of genes that may lead to increased virulence among human strains. Over the last decade, strains of avian influenza have decimated millions of chickens and other domesticated birds in eastern Asia. And now, scores of humans exposed to these viruses have developed serious infection, and many of these infected individuals have died. Joining us to discuss avian influenza is Niranjan Bhatt, a pediatrician and epidemiologist who is currently serving as an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. The study of influenza has been a major focus of Dr. Bhatt's research. Niranjan Bhatt, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Before we discuss avian influenza, I was wondering if we could first talk about influenza in general. I assume this is a family of related viruses. Tell us more about that.
Yes, influenza viruses are a group of related viruses. They're divided into types, known as type A, B, and C, with A and B being the most important in causing human disease. And then the type A influenza viruses are divided even further into subtypes. And that's based on two proteins on the virus surface, and we call them an H protein and an N protein. And since there are 15 kinds of H proteins and 9 types of N proteins, there are dozens of combinations you could make, and we call viruses by names such as H3N2 or H7N7 or H5N1. And one way I like to look at it is to consider these proteins to be like clothing. So the H protein could be a shirt, and an N protein could be a pair of pants. And so the H shirts can come in 15 different colors, and the N pants in 9 different colors, and you can make all kinds of combinations. You can wear a blue shirt with red pants or a green shirt with yellow pants to make up a subtype. But even within these subtypes, these viruses constantly change as they circulate through the population, trying to keep up with people's immunity. And so if a virus changes enough that we can tell it's different from before, we call it a new strain, although it still belongs to the same subtype. And so using my clothing example from before, a yellow shirt with red pants, it can remain in fashion for several years in a row, but the styles may change from year to year to keep up with fashion. So you'd have one year a button-down shirt, and then another year one with pockets in front. Sometimes you'll have corduroy pants. Sometimes you have, you know, jeans, that kind of thing.
And these changes that are going on in the virus are because those are strains that are beginning to have more success in evading the immune system of the animal they're trying to infect. Is that the idea?
In one way, you could say that it's more that the viruses are constantly trying to evade or escape people's immunity. So they constantly have to change because they want the population to remain vulnerable. And so they become more successful if they change their outer proteins.
And what different animal species are susceptible to illness from these types of viruses?
Well, there are a wide range of species. The main reservoir or source for influenza viruses are in wild migrating birds like wild geese and wild ducks. But they also infect a lot of other different birds, including domestic birds like chickens. And they also infect mammals such as pigs, horses. And then recently we've seen that they infect cats and dogs. And of course they infect humans.
Lately in the news media, we've been hearing a lot about avian influenza, mm-hmm. but we've not been hearing that human illness seems to be caused by the strains of influenza that mostly affect other mammals like pigs and horses. And I was wondering if there's something special about avian influenza, or is it just turn out to be more common so far, or is it our proximity to birds that seems to cause that? Do you have a sense about that?
Yeah, well, the main problem is that a specific avian influenza virus strain has been seen to jump into humans over the past few years, and this represents a risk to the human population because we've never been exposed to that virus subtype before. And this has not been seen to happen very much in influenza viruses that are specific to other mammals. The subtypes of virus are usually limited to a specific set of species and only jump sporadically to different species, usually when these viruses jump into a different species, it's not sustained in the population, and therefore we usually consider a virus to be an avian influenza virus if it's limited mostly to birds, and to be a horse influenza or equine influenza virus if it's limited mainly to horses. And what concerns us is when a virus jumps from one set of species to another, and that's mainly happened avian influenza viruses.
So when you say that a virus jumps species from birds to, say, humans, which is what the main focus of this interview is,
mm-hmm.
do you mean that humans that are around birds that are infected with this then contract a recognizable illness from that virus, which is largely a virus that affects birds? Or are you saying that at that point it's jumped species and now humans can transmit it to each other, no longer even needing the bird as a kind of vector of illness?
Right. Well, that's those are two essential steps that we worry about. One is the ability of the virus to go from a bird to a human, and then the second step, which doesn't necessarily follow, would be moving from one human to the next in an easy and sustained way. And what we've seen in the past few years have been instances of the first situation happening, where a human catches an influenza virus from a domestic bird or even a wild bird. But we have not yet seen any of these avian influenza viruses moving easily from human to human. And the type of disease that these avian influenza viruses cause are not necessarily going to look like the type of disease that you get with regular human influenza viruses. Now, regular human influenza viruses cause what most people call the flu, which is mostly in the respiratory tract. So you get a sore throat, cough, and breathing problems for the most part, and then also you get fever and body aches. But avian influenza viruses in birds cause vomiting and diarrhea, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to cause a respiratory disease in humans. However, in the avian influenza virus that was found in Vietnam and Thailand, there were a lot of pneumonias and other respiratory tract problems.
Among the humans?
Among the humans.
Changing diseases for a second and talking about West Nile disease, one of the problems with that disease is that it seems to be that it can spread widely because wild birds in the environment, which can travel long distances, can get this virus to go from one state to the next and infect all the way across the country. Is that a threat with avian influenza?
Well, it definitely is a concern that wild birds would be able to spread a particular strain that would be harmful to humans. As I said before, avian influenza viruses are very common in wild migratory birds like wild ducks and wild geese. And they have been shown to have the particular subtype of virus that we were worried about last year in Southeast Asia. And this particular subtype called H5N1 influenza has been found in wild birds in southern China. And so there's definitely the risk that these wild birds can spread it from Southeast Asia up to northern Asia into Japan or to other parts of the world. But we haven't yet seen any instances where those birds have been able to transmit to humans. There have been some hypotheses that the domestic birds in Southeast Asia got the infection from these wild birds, but it's not been fully documented at this point. So it seems like the main source of risk for humans are the large populations of poultry in many of the countries of Southeast Asia.
You mean that it turns out that the domesticated birds, like chickens, for instance, contract the illness from the wild birds, and then it gets transmitted from the domesticated animals to the humans?
Yes, and in the process of moving from the wild birds to the domesticated birds, it is thought that the virus has changed somewhat to become more pathogenic or more severe, because usually in wild birds, these influenza infections are actually pretty mild, or sometimes they don't have symptoms at all. And what was different about this H5N1 virus in Southeast Asia was that the domestic poultry were dying in the hundreds and thousands, and it is thought that this was due to changes and mutations in the virus. So if you combine the changes in the virus to make it more dangerous, as well as the increased exposure to humans due to their close contact with domestic poultry, this creates much higher risk for humans.
Well, let's talk now about the types of symptoms that people get from this illness. What we think of as human influenza leads to fever, achiness, and widespread respiratory symptoms, upper respiratory symptoms like stuffy nose and cough, and sometimes shortness of breath and fairly bad lung problems.
Correct.
Is that the same syndrome that people would manifest if they were to develop infection with an avian influenza virus?
The people that we know of so far who have been infected with H5N1 avian influenza have had pretty severe disease, including respiratory complications such as pneumonia. And our knowledge of what H5N1 influenza looks like is limited by the fact that we were only able to pick up the most severe cases, because it's very difficult in places like Vietnam and Thailand to do surveillance for all of the population. And so there may be a wide range of severity to avian influenza in humans, but we only know about the most severe cases because those are the ones that came to medical attention.
So you're saying that we have no idea about how common this illness is, because we don't know the lower end, the people who have very mild symptoms. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I would say that our knowledge is pretty limited in terms of the milder range of illness. So we can't say the total number of people who have had infection, nor what a mild disease would look like in humans. We can do surveys of populations through what they call serology, to look at past infection. And we can, for instance, do a survey of people in Vietnam and see how many people have evidence of having avian influenza at some point in the past. And they did a limited study like this in Hong Kong in 1997, and they showed that 10% of poultry workers had evidence of a previous infection with H5N1 influenza. But not all of those people had an illness that they could identify.
And I guess you'd also want to know what proportion of those people could transmit it to others.
Right.
And with that type of avian influenza, is that percentage low? Can that one be spread from human to human?
At this point, there has not been any evidence of sustained human-to-human transmission of H5N1 influenza, which is good news. We have looked at the cases that we were able to identify, and we looked at all of the contacts, including family members and hospital workers who took care of these cases, and did a full range of testing on most of these contacts, and at this point have not found evidence that the virus can be passed easily from person to person.
You were involved in the exploration of an avian influenza epidemic, was it, or outbreak, we'll call it?
Outbreak, yes.
I was
involved in Vietnam, exactly.
So tell us what the findings were there.
Well, this outbreak occurred in the context of an outbreak of H5N1 influenza in the domestic poultry in the region. And actually, this caused over 100 million birds to have either died or been destroyed. The outbreak began in poultry in December 2003, and eventually 8 countries reported outbreaks among their poultry. Beginning in January, there were reports of severe respiratory illness in northern Vietnam.
Among humans.
Among humans. And due to the fact that there was an outbreak of H5N1 in poultry, and due to the fact that H5N1 viruses had been shown to infect humans in a limited fashion in recent years, those people were tested for H5N1 and were found to have the H5N1 virus.
And how many cases were there among humans?
Well, As of today, there have been a total of 45 confirmed human cases of avian influenza in both Thailand and Vietnam, resulting in 32 deaths.
So when we recognize the illness, it's a very dangerous illness, it sounds like.
Yes, exactly. When we, among those that we have confirmed infection, it has been very severe. As I said, there were 32 deaths, but even among those who survived, many of them had severe illness.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that we have a potentially very severe illness if it's transmitted, but that the likelihood of it being transmitted sounds like it's pretty low, because you're talking about millions of birds that are infected and only several dozen human cases. Is that the case?
That's absolutely correct. At this point, we feel that the transmission potential of the current virus is quite low. Our concern is that influenza viruses evolve continuously and have the ability to swap genes with each other. And so either through continuous mutations or through swapping genetic material with regular human influenza viruses, this H5N1 strain may develop the ability to rapidly spread throughout the human population. And that's why the public health community feels it's so important to continue to identify as many cases of human avian influenza as we can and determine if there is human-to-human transmission.
Do you think that the SARS epidemic should or does have an influence on the attitude of the public health community toward avian influenza? In other words, an illness that rapidly was transmitted across continents through human travel.
It definitely opened up the eyes of many in the public health community to the rapid spread of diseases in this global society, and really helped those of us in the influenza world gain the attention of policymakers in thinking about pandemic influenza preparedness. Preparing for pandemic influenza has been in the process for many years, but the occurrence of the SARS epidemic definitely helped bring the issue to the forefront.
If I see a patient, say here in Vermont or really anywhere in the United States, with a severe respiratory illness, which I have to say is a common event, I take care of patients in the hospital who have pneumonia and significant respiratory illness really every day, every week. And the reason to start being concerned about something less common, like such as avian influenza, would be if there were what appeared to be a pattern or an outbreak, because that may be difficult to identify since we see so many cases to start with. And I guess I should add, maybe the general public may not realize that it's actually turns out to be very difficult when we're treating pneumonia and respiratory illness to determine which virus or bacteria is causing it. That turns out to be not an easy task in general.
That's correct. And so the public health community has the responsibility of watching for any of these outbreaks occurring in Southeast Asia in order to make sure we know the level of risk within the United States. And the way that a healthcare provider in the community can help to determine if a person is at risk for avian influenza is by asking not just questions about their illness, but also where they've been in the past few days. It's important to ask about travel history and exposure to animals. And those are ways that we can try to find out if they may be at higher risk for avian influenza.
I'd like to turn next to a discussion of the prevention of avian influenza.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to do that maybe starting off by picking up on something you just said that I found to be very intriguing. You said that clinicians like medical doctors, such as myself, when I'm treating patients with respiratory illness, I shouldn't just ask about whether they're having cough and shortness of breath, but also about what types of exposures they may have had in the previous week or two. And what you said was that if they had traveled abroad, that would be of interest.
Absolutely.
And obviously that's true. But you seem to indicate that if they had been exposed to poultry or animals only in the United States, that would be less concerns. One question I'd like to ask you about the prevention of avian influenza is there now or could there be a risk from animals who are being raised in the United States?
Well, currently there is no documented H5N1 influenza in the poultry of the United States, but we have had outbreaks of other types of avian influenza among poultry flocks within the past year.
In the U.S.?
In the United States. And so the U.S. Department of Agriculture has an extensive surveillance network to monitor for avian influenza, and it's really important for the animal health and the human public health experts to keep in communication with each other to help assess the level of risk within the United States. As I said, there have been outbreaks of avian influenza within flocks within the United States, but these virus strains have not been strains that show high level of danger to humans.
So back in 1997, when avian influenza first got a lot of publicity,
yes,
well over a million chickens were killed in Hong Kong, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. In retrospect, does that rather drastic action, slaughter of animals, does that action appear to have been necessary in retrospect?
Well, I think that right now that the culling of poultry flocks is the best defense we have until better weapons can be developed, such as vaccines. You mentioned that well over a million chickens had been culled during the Hong Kong epidemic, but in Southeast Asia, within the past year, over 100 million poultry either died or were exterminated in the efforts to control the outbreak. And right now, scientists are developing vaccines not only for humans but also for the poultry in an effort to develop a better weapon to combat these outbreaks as they occur. And vaccines have been put into trials in China, Thailand, and Indonesia.
Maybe we can return to the issue of a vaccine just in a minute, but mm-hmm. just finishing up on this issue of slaughtering millions of animals, Vietnam is a rather poor country, so is most of China still. And I guess it must be a huge sacrifice for those involved in the industry, whether they raise chickens or market them, to sacrifice large numbers of the animals that presumably they've worked on or bought. Are these slaughters undertaken after careful analysis, say with international consultants, say from our group, from the Center for Disease Control? And also, are these cullings or slaughters undertaken to protect other birds from getting it, or is the main reason to prevent the possibility of a human outbreak of avian influenza?
Well, our ultimate concern is definitely the prevention of a pandemic from occurring, and the only way to do that is to prevent human infections from happening. But there is also a definite concern that these outbreaks can spread from one flock to another. It's definitely a hard choice when recommending that chickens be culled in an effort to control outbreaks, and this was especially important in Vietnam and Thailand, where many of these flocks were family-owned and or were a major source of food for the community. And so it was very important for the governments to consider the consequences of these practices to the population. And to some extent, the government did try to compensate families for the loss of their chickens, but it really is very hard to really make up for the losses to the population.
Should the U.S. be importing poultry from other countries, particularly Asia?
Well, actually, I can't really answer that. That's not in my area of expertise.
The process of developing vaccines in general is future-oriented when the organism may be changing, and also you don't know how many cases may occur in the human population. Keeping those two issues in mind, how do you approach the development of a vaccine, and what is the CDC doing in that area?
Well, we are limited in our vaccine development by the fact that influenza vaccines have to be developed several months in advance, because vaccines are developed by growing in eggs for up to 6 to 9 months. And so we have to plan ahead when we choose what strains will go into a vaccine. And so avian influenza viruses are a moving target, and we must constantly sample the strains that occur in the community and target our vaccines to the newest strains. Currently, the NIH has developed a program to test a vaccine against the latest strains that we have identified in Southeast Asia, and these are going into clinical trials over the next few months. We hope that these will prove to be safe enough for humans to use, but it would not be a financial benefit to vaccine manufacturers to make a large amount of vaccine for an illness that may not actually occur. So it's up to the public health community to devote the resources to developing these vaccines against avian influenza.
And let's say that, in fact, you folks at the CDC succeed in developing an effective and safe vaccine. Do I then next year administer that to my patients? Or, I mean, how will that decision be made?
So the decision on when to start vaccination would depend on the level of risk in the world. And most governments around the world have developed pandemic plans that would help us decide when to start vaccinating the population against a potentially pandemic virus.
So you would expect that to occur after we start seeing cases here in the U.S.? Is that
Start to recommend that after there has been evidence of sustained human-to-human transmission anywhere in the world, because as we had discussed earlier, there is the potential for any kind of virus to spread throughout the world within a short period of time.
The final question I'd like to ask is, one of the reasons I'm covering this topic is because it's been now nearly a decade that we intermittently see coverage of bird flu, as it's named in the media, avian influenza as it's properly called. We've seen that covered in the media, and it appears in the media, then it's gone for a year or two and it comes back. Is this something that the general populace should be concerned or afraid about? Because each time it's portrayed, it seems in the guise of a scare.
Well, I think that it should be something that we should continuously be prepared for and watch for. Pandemics occur once every generation or so, and so we are due for one. What many of us say in the influenza world is it's not a question of if there will be another pandemic, but when. And the best defense we have is continuous monitoring of events around the world to detect any evidence that influenza viruses have jumped into the human population.
Well, Niranjan Bhatt, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
My pleasure.
Listeners wishing to learn more about influenza viruses, including avian influenza, can find more information at the CDC's website, which is www.cdc.gov. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.